Hello, everyone, and welcome to another installment of Podcast 360. I'm your moderator, Amanda Belby, with Neurology Consultant. I'm here today with Dr. Madeline C. Fields, who is an associate professor of neurology and co-director of the Mount Sinai Epilepsy Center at the Mount Sinai Hospital in New York, New York. She joins us today to answer our questions about the connection between epilepsy and autism. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Fields.
My pleasure.
So to start, can you give us some background on the connection between epilepsy and autism?
Sure. So the risk of epilepsy in persons with autism spectrum disorders is anywhere from 8 to 40%, which may seem like a very broad range, but that number is affected by many things, some of which we'll speak about in a couple minutes. The age of onset for epilepsy in autism spectrum disorders is bimodal, meaning that there are two peaks. So one is in early childhood between the ages of 2 and 5, and the second peak is in adolescence, and that peak is much larger. So the risk of developing a seizure disorder in persons with autism, it actually doesn't go away in childhood, but becomes greater as they grow older. And it is in autistic patients who have greater intellectual disability that are more at risk for developing epilepsy. In fact, intellectual disability is the greatest determinant of developing epilepsy in autism. So in patients who do not have intellectual disability but autism, the risk of developing epilepsy is about 8%. And in persons who have autism and intellectual disability, their risk is about 40%. In addition, epilepsy in children who have autism spectrum have a greater risk of mortality.
So how are children with epilepsy and autism diagnosed? Can they present without history of seizure?
You know, I think the most obvious is when a child has a convulsion, as it is in persons who don't have autism. You have a convulsion, you come to medical attention, and it is in retrospect often that we can get a sense as to whether or not there have been other seizure types occurring. So it may be that there were staring spells that were not easily distracted by the parent or caregiver. There might have been very stereotypic behavior or movements that particularly in this population that might have been mistaken for a stereotypy or like a behavioral movement that might have been a seizure. But I'd say the most common that I have seen in my experience is a convulsion. And then in retrospect, we often see other symptoms that are indicative of possibly having smaller seizures before.
And can you talk a little bit about the role of EEG in diagnosing patients with epilepsy and autism?
Sure. Sometimes it is very difficult to get an EEG in certain patients. Oftentimes it's a piece of cake. The EEG can be very revealing in that if it shows epileptiform discharges, even after a very first seizure, the level of suspicion that someone's going to have another seizure goes up immensely. There's a caveat there, though, because we know that in people who have autism and have never had a seizure that we know of, research has shown that they are much more likely to have seizure waves or epileptiform discharges on their EEG almost to 80% of the time, which may or may not be predictive of developing a seizure disorder or not. The thinking is that just someone in a patient with autism, that having all of these abnormal waves on the EEG probably does in some way contribute to behavior and cognition and language adversely. But as far as sort of going back to your question, that an EEG can really help with the diagnosis of epilepsy or seizure disorders in this population, as it does in the general population as well.
What treatment options are currently available for this patient population?
So they're more or less the same as the general population. I will say it goes more into the art of medicine, where we probably tend to stay away from medications that may exacerbate or destabilize mood and may move toward medications that are more mood stabilizing, depending upon what the underlying problems or issues may be day to day. But the same medications are available. And like the population that's not autistic, it depending upon if it's a focal epilepsy or a generalized epilepsy, we move toward one set of medications or another. The same percentage of the autistic population is refractory to medications from the limited studies that we do have, which is about 30%, meaning that no matter what medication you give, it's not going to stop the seizures. And in that case, there are even fewer studies looking at surgeries in this population, which is a direction we tend to take with children and adults who are medically refractory, is evaluate them for possible epilepsy surgery.
So what happens when a patient is refractory to medication? What is the next step?
Other considerations would include things that are considered like alternative therapies or complementary therapies. So for example, the ketogenic diet or the modified Atkins diet, which are two diets that are well studied in the epilepsy population. They're often very difficult to do for anyone because they can be quite restrictive, but there's a ton of data out there to suggest that these diets can work as well as a medication a lot of the time, and in some patients really can rid them of their seizures if they're able to maintain the diet. A different alternative or complementary therapy, which is really big in the media these days, is cannabidiol, which is one of the products of medical marijuana. And very recently, Epidiolex, which is cannabidiol, was approved for the treatment of epilepsy in particular patient populations, specifically those with Lennox-Gastaut and Dravet, which many people with autism or autistic-like features would fit into this group. The next thing to consider, or things that we do consider when people are refractory to medication, is surgery. The surgical workup in cases of people with autism is very similar to that in the epilepsy population. And the data that we have in this particular population is limited. And there's some data to suggest that it can be very helpful, not only from a seizure standpoint, but from a behavioral standpoint. But on the flip side of that, there's also data to suggest that the various surgical interventions are not helpful. But just to give you a sense of what that might look like. So things that are available for people who have medically refractory epilepsy are things such as a VNS or vagal nerve stimulator, which is a small device that's put into the chest wall, and then a wire goes up the vagal nerve, and it is thought through neuromodulation that this can help people with refractory epilepsy. It has been looked at in the autistic population, again, with mixed reviews. Other options are resective surgeries. If you can identify a focus where the seizures are coming from, it is thought that not infrequently in this patient population that the nature of the epilepsy is complicated. It can be from more than one focus, or can be from a focus and combined with generalized epilepsy. So it can be more challenging. But the workup would include doing what we normally do, which is a video EEG that may or may not be followed by something called, what we often do at our institution, a stereo EEG, which is an intracranial study. And then depending upon where the focus is coming from, you would then decide if the patient is a candidate for a resective surgery or a device such as an RNS or a NeuroPace, which is its own talk in itself. What was even more recently approved is something called a DBS, or deep brain stimulator, which has been approved for years in the Parkinson's population, but is now approved in the epilepsy population as well.
As another, I guess, therapeutic option, you have the NeuroPace, which is a relatively new device. What is the NeuroPace and how does it benefit this population of patients with epilepsy and autism?
So I'm going to answer your last question first, which is we don't know. There are absolutely zero studies looking at this device in this particular population. So it is a relatively new device. There are some studies on the vagal nerve stimulator. There are some studies looking at surgical resections, but not with this device in particular. And in this population, NeuroPace is interesting and important device because very often these seizures come from both sides of the brain and there's no resection that can ever get at that. And the indication for the use of the device are also if the seizures come from eloquent cortex. And lastly, we sometimes use this device, not infrequently, sort of for compassionate care as a way to really help this patient population that is oftentimes devastated neurologically from the seizures. And so this particular device does not take anything out of the brain. It serves as, the analogy is like a pacemaker. So it is it's a small computer that sort of sits inside the skull and it records brain waves and then it treats them. So when it sees abnormal activity, like when it senses a seizure, it will actually deliver stimulation, much like a pacemaker would, to defibrillate an abnormal heartbeat. It tries to defibrillate the seizures.
That's really interesting. Thank you for joining us today and sharing your expertise with us.
My pleasure.